Wednesday, June 15th. Helen woke me at 6:15 to begin my big day, and I tried to slip quietly from the bed so as not to wake Lyndon. But he did waken, and he talked so sweetly and so sadly about my going and being away for a week or so that it gave me a pang, and I wondered if I was being selfish to want to insulate myself in silence and nature and solitude and leave the endless problems behind for a while. I went in to kiss Lucy goodbye, and as I leaned over to put my face on her velvet cheek, I heard the little tinkle of Hem's tags on his collar. He had spent the night in Lucy's room. He is her most comforting companion, and love is bountifully returned. I went in and kissed Linda. I did not ask what her plans were. I did not want to know, because what I don't know, I cannot inadvertently let slip. 22, with her sound character, good heart, good judgment, it's time she started making her own decisions. If the press cuts her up for fighting for whatever privacy she can get, she'll have to live with that, too. And then I walked out at 8:05. I was at National to join Liz and the small party of about 9 on a Jetstar. We were airborne 8:15 with a good breakfast served on board and the fullest agenda of any day of the year. On the way, I read my speeches, 5 of them, over several times, and the briefing on every stop in Omaha. We arrived practically on time at Offutt Air Force Base, the nerve center of SAC. There, at the foot of the plane, was Governor Frank Morrison and pretty Mrs. Morrison, and Mayor and Mrs. A.V. Sorensen of Omaha, and General and Mrs. Nazaro, Vice Commander of SAC, and lo and behold, Colonel Bill Reynolds, who had been with us on that happiest of all vacations, when Lyndon took me to Paris to NATO in the fall of 56. I'll always remember him walking bouncily along without purchases from the flea market, brass bed warmer on its long stick, and Eloise's huge white lavabo, thus just as though this were the most pleasant duty any officer could have. Seeing Bill was a good augury for the day to me. It was bound to be a good day. He showed me a picture of old Fort Crook, taken at the turn of the century, showing it as a barren prairie. But those early officers and soldiers, bless them, had been tree-planting folks, and now there were winding streets lined with huge elms and pleasant green lawns and old-fashioned red brick houses with which had been combined the great expansions of the jet age as it became the headquarters for SAC. And we went past the Strategic Airspace Museum, a 10-acre outdoor site where there were parked missiles and aircraft that had been used by SAC in its 20-year history. It must be a very mecca for little boys that like and identify airplanes, and for all those who remember them from past combats just as though they were people, as Lyndon and some of those who were with him talked about the spruce. At the end of the tour, I went to the lawn in front of the SAC headquarters for the welcoming ceremonies. We looked out on a beautiful, rolling, verdant countryside, and there were about 3,000 servicemen and their families, all the children in front, of course. And it was here, I believe, that the charm of the day first took hold of me. One writer described it. It was a day of flowers and flags, bands and balloons, cameras and kids, gifts and greetings, and gorgeous summertime weather. Bill Reynolds, General Nazaro, Mayor Sorensen, and Governor Morrison all made brief remarks. The wind was whipping into our faces right off the prairie, and suddenly right behind me was a wild clatter. I knew some of the flags on standards behind me had gone over in a gust of wind. I jumped, but was proud of myself for not turning around. And with military discipline, the speaker went right on. It's at times like this on platforms when I really know what bouquets are good for. Also programs, also purses. They're useful to cover your knees in this day of incredibly short skirts. My few words were mostly of praise for the someone, or many someones, who'd had the foresight to plant these trees years ago. For those service people who felt that home is not a place back over the hill behind us. It is wherever we are. And I am thrilled to pay tribute to the thousands of people over the years who have made Offutt their home and left it a little more lovely every time. And then I planted a 2-year-old seedling from the John Quincy Adams American elm that grows on the White House lawn. I'm beginning to think that tree is mighty prolific. I hope there's just one left for the ranch of the Johnson City House. And then suddenly the sack band struck up America. And Mrs. Frank Morrison, in a beautiful voice, began to sing. I lifted my head and joined her as I continued shoveling in a few more spades full of dirt. And all the kids in the crowd were singing too. And there was one of those rare moments of enchantment when you feel that you're one with all those around you. I am a sucker for that song. Have to blink back the tears because the words of it come straight out of my heart. Then I went around the crowd, shaking hands with as many of the people as I could reach, smiling, calling greetings. They're the most wonderful sights you see in crowds like this. Once there were six little girls, I could hardly believe it, all dressed alike in blue. I didn't know whether it was a school uniform or what. I asked, and one of the little girls said, "We're sisters." I hugged the smallest one. The Texans always identify themselves. Nearly everywhere I meet someone who's a good friend of someone I know. And then we were back in the car. I rode with Mayor and Mrs. Sorensen and the governor, and I learned from them how the mayor had proposed a bond issue to combat the solution of the Missouri River some 75 years ago. The packing houses, Omaha's most important industry, I gathered, built their plants right along the river so they could use it as a sort of a sewer in which to pour all the refuse from their business. The bond issue provides a chemical treatment of this refuse before it is put into the river. It sounded like a good step forward, though I don't know that it's just palliative or cure. And then the mayor told me about his Operation Alert, which attempted to enlist the ardent cooperation of everybody who worked for the city, some 2,000 or so, doing a better job of maintaining and beautifying Omaha, to create a spirit of teamwork among them, and through their example and leadership, to create a sort of yeast that might work through the whole population of Omaha. He put the top of the car down. There were certainly no great masses of people to meet me. But on the other hand, there were probably as many as greet a lot of foreign chiefs of state on our Washington parades. We went to the assembly hall in downtown Omaha. There were about 600 Omaha City employees, including the street cleaners. My message was totally self-sale. A memory of Omaha winning the National Cleanest Town Trophy. Praise for what they were doing, reminding that beauty is really everyone's business. And a word about Lyndon. High standards of public service are very important to the president, and I know he will be proud to hear of this remarkable program when I get home to tell him about it. He asked me to bring each of you his greetings and best wishes. Always, in every speech, I say something like that, because that is why I am there, mostly. The mayor presented me with a painting by a Nebraska artist. A typical Nebraska farm scene, the artist explained. I liked it, both for the day and for the painting itself. And then at 10:20, right on time, I was on my way, heading for Boys Town, once more with the governor as my guide. Here, Monsignor Wegner met us and gave us a tour through the grounds, telling us that about 900 boys, of all faiths and backgrounds, live here. They come as young as 10 years old, on up to 16, and stay until they are 18, except, of course, for the dropouts. It is his unhappy job to choose from the 3,000 or so applicants they get each year, the 200 or so they are able to take in. He proudly told me that they had boys in all walks of life, every profession, doctors, lawyers, big businessmen, and about as high a percent of successes as there would be in the average high school class. The alumni of Boys Town keep in touch and get together in New York or Seattle, wherever life took them. And every few years, there were big reunions right here at Boys Town, which great numbers of the alumni return. He was full of his subject in that extraordinary way Catholic priests often have, which sometimes make me think they would have made good as advertising executives, too. He said the famous Father Flanagan, who started Boys Town, had a great faith in divine providence, as he put it, and had gotten the school planned and obligated to expand to some astronomically high figure, and then Father Flanagan died, leaving him his successor to execute these ambitious plans. Somehow, it had all come out all right. After we had toured the grounds, seen the dormitories and bungalows where the boys of various ages lived, and the staff houses, and very beautiful grounds they were, and so well kept, and the regular high school and the vocational school, and I kept on telling the Monsignor. But in the vocational school, I hoped they had some sort of a course, nursery work that might lead to jobs in park maintenance or highway beautification, and he kept on seeming to think that I was only referring to how well they kept the grounds there, which was quite true. And then when the tour ended, a lot of very delightful things happened, all quite quickly. I was escorted through an honor guard formed by Boys Town High School students, up a red carpet to a speaker's platform, where a red-coated, freckle-faced, very serious young man, about 9, Kenneth Gehrig, welcomed me to the city of little men in a well-done speech without a single note. I could have hugged him. And then acting mayor Patrick Coggins, about 16, I would say, very handsome, poised young man, presented me with the first Boys Town High School diploma ever awarded to a lady. I was made an honorary citizen. Two little girls, about 4 and 6, all dressed up, wandered up to the platform before their mother could reach them. I gave a group of books, mostly about the White House, one about Lyndon, to the Boys Town Library. One of them inscribed, "With warm best wishes to each of you in the prayer that you grow up in a peaceful America." Monsignor Wegner responded with a prayer for the president and his burdens, and a gift for him, a little statue that is a symbol of Boys Town, a youngster carrying his small brother, and the motto, "No, mister, he's not heavy, he's my brother." And then there was a bit of laughter. I was presented with a donkey, brought up to me by 2 young residents of Boys Town, both Texans. Right. He was a solemn, amiable-looking donkey, and he actually had bangs. Fortunately, I didn't have to carry him back on the plane with me. He'd been given to President Truman. He'd been given to all the visitors who come, maybe even to Lucy. And she came during the campaign. But he was always allowed to remain here at his home in Boys Town. The famous choir of Boys Town sang 2 beautiful numbers, and I went over to thank them. They were earnest, good young faces. I kept on thinking, this is great, I love it. It very probably means a constructive future for the 200 who get in each year. But what of the other 2,800 who don't? And then it was time to go, and on the way out, I asked the Monsignor, "Tell me something about what happened to the boys when they leave." "Well, about 60% of them go into the service. And there are plenty of jobs waiting for those who've been prepared in the vocational schools. Industry's most cooperative. There's no scarcity of opportunity for them, and each one is guided into a job, and a smaller percentage goes on to college." How, I didn't get to hear, because by this time we were at the gate. It was time to say goodbye. And then the governor and I had about a 50-mile drive from Boys Town to the capital of Nebraska, Lincoln. It had been settled before the Civil War, but was renamed after the Civil War, after President Lincoln. We rode on Highway 80. It already showed the marks of landscaping. Groupings of young trees, I did not recognize them. Some a silvery gray-green, so pretty I wished I knew what they were. Sometime the banks of the roads were covered with a rather tall-growing plant with yellow blooms. The governor told me it was clover. And then in the median strip, there would be low-growing white and pink clover, and fields of lavender, which he said was alfalfa. But the most thrilling sight of all were the fields of wheat waving in the wind, like an ocean reaching on across the horizon as far as you could see sometimes. It was a rich country. The farmhouses looked well kept, places you could love. I asked him how much land sold for here, and he said about $500 per acre, way out in the country, or maybe $1,000 as you neared town. It was just about my favorite part of the day. He used an interesting expression, "The state slept for 30 years. And another one, when I asked him how he became interested in conservation, and he said, well, he'd gone through the Dust Bowl period. His father had died when he was 2.5 years old. He'd had a pretty hard time growing up, with his mother making a living, Kansas and in Nebraska. The Dust Bowl years would shock anybody into thinking about it. We reached the governor's mansion almost on time, right after noon. Amazingly enough, a very southern, white-columned Georgian house, handsome, dignified, right across from the Capitol building, which has a gold dome with a statue poised on top of the sower, figure of a man spreading seed. The governor told me that the statue had been put up there after the gold dome was completed, and it was quite a feat, engineering-wise, to get this figure, which weighed several tons and had to be balanced, poised atop the dome. I went in just long enough to freshen up, and then quickly to the Cornhusker Hotel, a well-named, I love the names I've come across, and looking at the map on the way, there were several, Red Cloud, Broken Bow, many that show an Indian heritage. And at the Cornhusker Hotel was the main meeting of the day, what I had actually come for, the Governor's Conference on Natural Beauty. It was part of a day-long session, opening talks in the morning, three workshops in the afternoon, a luncheon with several speeches. I was one of them. There were about 450 community leaders present. Governor's Council to Keep America Beautiful sponsored the meeting, along with the Game and Soil and Water Commissions and the Nebraska Roads Department and Division of Resources. Mrs. Leslie Anderson of Omaha was the spark plug of the day, I gathered. It is a conservative state on which the real pressure of urban living has not yet made the dent it has in the crowded East. And so, quite naturally, litter prevention was the key of the day. It's the least controversial, a sort of opening wedge to all the things that come later. I was famished, the luncheon was good, the room was hot. My speech was far too long, I thought, but I gave it my best, still running on the high octane feeling I had gotten in the early morning when I landed at Offutt Air Force Base and saw Bill Reynolds and heard America the Beautiful. Mostly, my speech was praise of Nebraska, the big sky country, underlining some headlines of the past year in the battle for beauty, the dedication of Reese Plaza in New York, the work we'd done in Washington, 400,000 flowering bulbs in the parks and roadsides, 16,000 shrubs and 5,000 trees, school ground beautification in Washington, and mention of the Youth Conference in Washington for Natural Beauty just 10 days from now. Actually, later on, I met two of the delegates to it. What we could hope for from the Highway Beautification Act, a salute to Nebraska for beginning Arbor Day, the most popular of beautification institutions, and then a bit of a challenge to them for their centennial year, 1967, to make their state, which is the passageway between the crowded eastern seaboard and the vacation land of the west, become more and more a place to go to as well as through when its scenic and historic features are wisely developed. It has the Oregon Trail and the Mormon Trail, and the route of the Lewis and Clark expeditions, and the Niobrara River, and the Sand Hill Country, and many inviting-sounding places. It seemed interminable, but I felt I did it fairly well. I was given a charm, the outline of the state of Nebraska, with a little diamond at Lincoln, by Mrs. Anderson of the Beautification Committee. And then when the luncheon was over, the governor and I, and Mrs. Marston, whom I admire more every time I see her, went out to stand in line and say hello to all the delegates. It is a symptom of the West, where people are not crowded, that receiving lines linger, and everybody has something to say. There were only 500 of them, but it went slowly. I was the one who had wanted it. I do enjoy it, but I began to realize, about two-thirds of the way through, that I was bone tired. There are always interesting moments. It was the girl who knew Karnak and Daddy's store, and the brick house, and the youngsters I would see in 10 days, the National Youth Conference, the garden club lady I had met at Jackson Hole. Finally, about an hour behind schedule, we left the Cornhusker and returned to the mansion in time for a good hour's rest for the Nebraska Land Day's Parade. I simply merged into the sheets and turned into a vegetable with no feelings or plans. And then it was time to go to the Nebraska Lands Parade, sort of pageant of history. I put on my bright red suit and my most enthusiastic smile and started out the door. There were 330 girl staters in convention in Lincoln who had assembled around the mansion to serenade us. I knew just the governor's predicament. They had petitioned him to put me on their program. He couldn't squeeze me in. This was his suggestion, and a good one. Okay. They sang patriotic songs, ending with Beautiful Nebraska, the first time I'd heard it, and a delightfully tuneful song. Okay. Thanks, handshakes, waves, then into an open convertible, preceded by the press car. They soon asked us, the governor and Mrs. Morrison and me, if we'd sit up on the back seat. We rode through the downtown section of Lincoln, acting as the parade's grand marshal before some 75,000 people, trying to give them what they gave me. Interest, attention, excitement, often a loving greeting. God bless you. God bless the president. It was about that time that Jerry came up to me with word it was bad weather between Lincoln and Texas. I would either fly back through a pretty turbulent front, or else go back in the jet to Washington, flying high enough and off the route, missing it, or spend the night here. The front would go through by 3 o'clock, and leaving early tomorrow morning. Mrs. Marston rose handsomely to the occasion, said it would be no trouble at all to spend the night. I decided I'd far rather do that than be frightened for hours, as I had been returning from New York. And if it's Dale's advice, I'd better take it. The governor led me up to the reviewing stand while Mrs. Marston went home to attend to some details, alas, of my staying. For over an hour, we watched floats go by from some 55 communities. My favorite was a Conestoga wagon pulled by oxen. There were Indian dancers in feather head dress and jingling bells up and down their legs and red paint and others that didn't need the red paint. About 55 communities had sent in bands and scores of floats. Remarkably enough, many of them related to the water. Had boats, bathing girls, water ski equipment on them, and the governor told me there was a series of lakes in Nebraska. How much you can learn about your own country by going to sea. There was a wagon train that had actually come in across the prairie from Fairbury along the Oregon Trail. The frying pans and coffee pots, and a big pot to cook beans in, dangling from the sides. And one little Indian, about 6 years old, riding bareback, was swinging a tomahawk as natural as you please. There were a lot of beautiful horses, palominas, paints, every kind, and Western clothes from about 1840 to 1966 versions. Of course, the inevitable clowns throwing candy to the crowd. One of them hit me on the head. I promptly picked it up off the floor and ate it. Days like this find me constantly hungry. And I love the stagecoaches. Quite authentic looking ones. The governor assured me they had carried passengers and mail along the trail. And they varied from small ones that would hold only about 4 people to great big ones that would hold about 12. They usually were full of lovely ladies dressed just like Miss Kitty. And it would be a man riding a shotgun, which the governor explained to me, on top. And there were several older ladies in quite authentic calico and sunbonnets. And all the time, there was a constant stream of people coming up and being introduced or sitting for a while in the reviewing stand with us. 3 pretty little girls, Zeta Tau Alphas, sorority sisters of Linda's, of course. And then a little girl named Linda Johnson, age 6, whose birthday was August 27th. Blonde with a top knot, who sat silently but quite poised beside me for a while. And we talked about her family and which floats we like best. Later I heard, when asked if this was the most thrilling thing that had ever happened to her, she solemnly shook her head and said no when asked what it was. She says, when Mama and Papa took me on a vacation to Missouri. Good sense, I thought. Finally, her little sister Shelley came up with a very proprietary air, grabbed her by the hand and says, you've got to come right now. Mother says so. And then Jerry leaned over the railing and said to me, Mrs. Johnson, I know I shouldn't tell you this now. There's been an accident. To him. I said, no, no, don't tell me. An angry, foolish outburst. And then, how bad? Pretty bad, he said. And Lucy's very much upset. I think you ought to call her as soon as you can. I knew there was more to go through. Charlton Heston was going to be given the Buffalo Bill Cody Award for producing good family entertainment, particularly Westerns. And I had been asked to stand up as the governor presented it to him and say a word of congratulations and cheers, so I couldn't go right then. Handsome and lean, he came up. I remembered how nice he had been at the ill-starred White House Festival of the Arts, June of 65, and how I'd enjoyed sitting by him at luncheon at the National Gallery of Art. A very attractive man. The governor presented the award, and then they gave us 2 big Western hats. I put mine on for the inevitable picture, and Charlton Heston, very quick on the uptake, said, Mrs. Johnson can just wear hers in parades. I can use mine making my living. He told me he'd been out to Vietnam. He thought our troops were wonderful out there. And he had just returned from speaking to a Chamber of Commerce group and to the press, a rather unlikely audience, to say a good word about our presence in Vietnam, in this part of America, I expect. I knew I would continue being numb until it was appropriate to leave, but I did hurry it up a bit. We left the stands about 6:30. Back at the mansion, I talked to Lucy. She was crying heartbrokenly. "Oh, Mother, he was just out on the lawn chasing a squirrel. And, oh, Mother, I just seen him when I came in from the party. I wanted to play with him, but I went upstairs to change my clothes. And if I hadn't been so long changing my clothes, I'd been back down there with him, and I'd been holding him and petting him, and he wouldn't have been killed." She was inconsolable. Pat was there with her. "Dear little girl. Poor all of us. But most of all, somehow, I think of Lyndon. He loved all four of the dogs, but him most of all. Him had inherited his daddy's quality of knowing when you felt bad or worried and sticking right by you when you did, not demanding any attention, not saying anything, but just being there. I asked Lucy to tend to her daddy and comfort him. She said, "Oh, Mama, I tried, but you know he can't stand crying, and I can't stop." I told her to go ahead and cry it all out. Mrs. Morrison came in and gave me a drink. It was very welcome. Then she and the governor were going to a dinner in honor of Charlton Heston at 7:30. But first we had a pleasant little talk. I really got to review with the governor what he thought his chances were. And he said, "You must understand, first, the state is 60% Republican and 40% Democratic. And it's just a question of whether the state is ready to accept someone who wants to move forward. They know me for that." And he spoke of how Curtis had been in office for 28 years and had done a great many favors for people that crossed party lines. He said, however, that he had made on an average of 500 speeches a year every year that he had been governor. And his wife must be a great help. "I do not think it will be easy, but I will watch with great interest." I told him how earnestly Lyndon had wanted me to come out there and how concerned he was about him, the governor. "A thousand thanks for a wonderful time." And then Mrs. Morrison, so thoughtfully, had me a delicious broiled steak and fruit salad brought on a tray to my room. I ate a good dinner and fell into bed about 8:30, fished some books out of my suitcase. I was just finishing The Plague by Camus, the last of B. Traven's stories headed by the night visitor, a wonderful writer, little known, that is, to me. And then very early, before 10 o'clock, I went to sleep, feeling that it was a different world, that I would awake to a different world, there would be a little hole in it, a vacant spot that him had filled so warmly.